This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodl Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Joining us on the Jodcast today is Professor Rob Izzard from the Arlonga Institute for Astronomy, and I'd like to say welcome back to the Jodcast.
It's nice to be back.
So, you've been giving a talk at the University of Manchester about the mischievous J-type stars. So, what is a J-type star?
Well, there, let's go back a step first, before we describe them. There's a whole group of stars in the sky, which are big, red, giant stars, very bright. We see lots of them, called carbon stars. And as you guessed from the name, that means they have carbon in them. It's very easy to see in the spectrum. You don't need a quality spectrum, so you can spot them very easily. The J-type stars are a subset of these carbon stars. And they're mischievous because all the other ones we think we understand. At least we think we know where they came from. Normal, these N-type normal carbon stars, they're normal, but they're not boring. But they come from the very evolved stars burning helium and hydrogen. So they get this carbon that's built in the core and they drag it up to the surface, a sort of convective mixing type thing, like a giant cloud. There's other ones, like the R-types. The R-types that we think are mergers, they're quite fun. There's the CH type, which are in binary systems. They accrete. But the J types, they're about 10% of all the carbon stars. And up to now, we have no model at all for how they're made.
So carbon stars are evolved stars, so stars like our sun that have gone past the main sequence and towards the end of their lives.
That's right.
And these all have carbon in.
That's right.
And then there's a subset of four different types of stars.
Yep.
And then we have our mischievous J-type stars that we don't really
That's
know
right.
much about.
So the thing is, to make the carbon, you have to take three helium nuclei, these alpha particles, and slam them into each other. And to do that, you have to have already done the hydrogen burning and be well into helium burning. So they're very evolved stars. And these J-stars, yes, they make up a subset of these carbon stars.
So you said we know a lot about the other type of stars, and then these are the mysterious ones. What do we know about the other stars, and why are these J-stars different?
A good example were the CH stars, for example. If you look at those, they are all binary stars, and they all show the signature of being a companion. So you can imagine if the sun was throwing off huge amounts of material, some of that hits the Earth. I mean, we see that in these solar storms, right? Now imagine if the sun's throwing off a load of carbon, and some of that hits the Earth, it would stick to the Earth. And that's what a CH-type star is. So in those, we look at them, and they're all binaries. Converse to that, the R-type stars are all single stars. So we think they all come from mergers. Because if you look at stars in the sky, about half of them are binaries. So if you see a single group of stars that are all single stars, and they don't have companions, they must be mergers. So those two are quite interesting.
So by a merger, you mean a binary, a double system, where two stars are combined to make one star?
Exactly that. Exactly that. That's right. And it very separately from this, but very recently, were observations of a merging star where we could measure the period of the star. And you see the period, this is the time it takes for the stars to go around each other. So for the Earth around the sun, that's 1 year. But for these stars, it was much less. And you could see it getting shorter and shorter and shorter until eventually there was a huge outburst of light from the system, and now the star is a single star. It's a very rare event, but we have seen it probably twice now.
Are these gas giants merging together, or do we not know anything about their...
I think there are two that I know of that are confirmed mergers, where we've actually seen the period change until they merge. But they were very different types of stars. One of them was a big giant merging with a companion star. In the other case, it was a very young star that was merging with its companion. Merging is something, I think, that happens at many different stages in the evolution of stars. They can be young, they can be old.
So that's two of the stars, the C stars that you described.
Yep.
What about the other two?
So the N-type stars are the end of the evolution for stars roughly 1.5 times the mass of the sun up to 3 times the mass of the sun. So they go through hydrogen burning, which is like the sun now, and then they go through a period of helium burning, and eventually the core becomes rich in carbon, because that's the product of helium burning, and then the envelope expands and expands, gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and some of this core, which has carbon in it, is mixed to the surface. So these stars that we see There's many of them in the sky. They're very bright. You see them in companion galaxies, such as the Magellanic Clouds. They're very easy to spot. These are the N-type carbon stars. And those we understand pretty well. We've been studying them for about 50 years now. So they're pretty well understood, qualitatively at least. So. But then the final type is the J-type. Now, these are special because they have what's called an isotope of carbon, the C13, which is slightly heavier than most of the carbon in stars. If you take three alpha particles and you hit them into each other at high speed, high temperature, this is what is done to make the carbon. This is the helium burning. But each of these alpha particles contains two protons, two neutrons. So they have a mass of four. There's three of them, and three times four is 12. So why is it in these stars we see a lot of carbon-13 instead of carbon-12? How is it made? And that's a big mystery. We really do not know.
Some of our listeners may be familiar with carbon-14, which is another example, for instance, of an isotope of carbon, which is using radioactive dating.
Sure.
So this is, the carbon-13 is a different isotope abundance.
Yes, and you see it on the Earth. If you look at the carbon on the Earth, a lot of it is carbon-13. If you look in the Sun, it's, I think, one part in 90 or so in the Sun is carbon-13. So it's quite natural for carbon-13. It's a stable isotope, so it continues to exist.
So in these J stars, you see the carbon-13 ratio different to the other C stars.
Yeah, so most carbon stars have a ratio similar to the Sun, maybe about 50 or 100 or something like that, large ratio. This is quite natural because a lot of carbon-12 is made, so if you divide the amount of carbon-12 by 13 and you've got a lot of carbon-12, that means you have a large number. If you look at the J-type stars, the ratio is always less than 10. Which implies something has happened to the carbon-12. Something weird that we don't understand. And the best process we know for doing this is hydrogen burning. So hydrogen burning will deplete your carbon-12 and convert it to carbon-13. The problem is, hydrogen burning then proceeds to take your carbon-13 and turn it into nitrogen-14. If you add a proton to 13, you go up to 14, and that happens to be nitrogen. So you can fine-tune your model, your stellar model, to give you exactly the right amount of carbon-13, but you have to be very careful not to destroy that and make nitrogen. And this is incredibly difficult to do. And while it can be done, in theory, the number of stars predicted by this mechanism is tiny. And yet we see 1 in 10 carbon stars is a J-type star. So something else is doing this.
And what could that something else be?
Well, nobody was really sure, and we're still not really sure, but we've got a wacky new idea. The thing is, if you look at the abundances in these J-type stars, it's not just the carbon-13 that is large. They also show a lot of lithium. They also show very strange nitrogen isotope ratios. This is nitrogen-14 to 15. Also oxygen ratios. There are three stable isotopes of oxygen. That's 16, 17, and 18. And the ratios show a great scatter in these stars, whereas in most of the stars, you don't see that.
Can we infer, how do we know about all these ratios? Are these all from spectra?
These are all from spectra, yes, exactly. You need high-resolution spectra. It's very difficult work.
So instruments like Herschel, for instance, a space telescope?
Yeah, absolutely. The higher resolution you can get, the better. Absolutely.
And then you see lines of all nitrogen and carbon.
Well, the thing is that the wavelength of the line depends to some extent on the mass of the atom. So if you're looking at carbon-12, what we look at in the lines are actually molecular lines. So that's carbon joined to another carbon, say in C2. Now, usually this will be a carbon-12 joined to a carbon-12. This is the most common. But in a J-type star, the carbon-12 is sometimes joined to a carbon-13, which gives you a line at a slightly shifted wavelength. And so instead of seeing one line, you see a sort of sister line next to it that is it's a little bit weaker, but you always see these in the J-type stars. They're very prominent. Whereas most stars that are carbon stars, you just see one set of lines.
And this is how we know that some funny chemistry is occurring, and we don't really know why that's happening.
Exactly. We don't know why it's happening. But we get a clue from these isotope ratios. We get a very big clue. Some of the J-type stars have what are called non-equilibrium values of carbon-13. Now, what this means is that it's not normal hydrogen burning that has done it. In normal hydrogen burning in stars, you can go down to ratios of around carbon 12 to 13 of around 4. You cannot go below. It's very, very difficult. So we looked at physical sites where you could go below this, because some of the J-type stars are down to about 2. The only place in the universe we know where this is done is in explosive hydrogen burning. And there's only one way of doing that, and that's in what's called a thermonuclear nova.
A thermonuclear nova? Wow.
Exactly, exactly.
That sounds pretty amazing.
Well, for those of you out there who like looking through their telescopes, these are also known as classical novae. So that's the less, I mean, that's the less dangerous way of putting it, I think. But what they are is when you have a white dwarf star. This is a star that's about the size of the Earth, but about half the mass of the Sun. So it's very, very dense. And you accrete material on it in a binary system from a companion.
So accrete, you actually gave a very good example about this. I want to let you go and explain what accretion is.
Accretion is when you take a companion star and put it very close. And what happens is it's so close that the gravity of the white dwarf sucks material off it. And the star is just a normal star like the Sun, but it cannot sit where it is so close without this material being sucked across onto the white dwarf. So the white dwarf becomes covered in a layer of hydrogen. Now, the white dwarf is very, very massive, so this layer gets squashed on the surface, and the pressure goes up, the temperature goes up, and eventually you reach the point where the temperature is so high that the hydrogen ignites. However, the conditions on a white dwarf are such that this ignition is essentially a thermonuclear bomb exploding on the surface of the white dwarf. Now, we've all seen what happens when you explode a nuclear bomb. It's a big, big explosion. Now, imagine it being much, much bigger, and that's the one you get from the star. And it's so big that it drives off a shell of material from this star. I don't know if you've seen the end of Star Wars where the Death Star explodes. Everyone knows that. Imagine that coming off a star. That's what a nova's like. Now, your companion star, your little solar-like star, that's like the Sun, it'll get hit by this. This material will slam back into it. And some of it will then stay on the companion star and pollute it. And the great thing about a nova explosion is that the material that's burnt, you start with lots of carbon-12, and in the nova you can convert some. In fact, this drives the initial explosion. You convert it to carbon-13 by adding protons, and that releases energy. And that's what drives the bomb, essentially. But because it expands very, very quickly, it doesn't have time to convert the carbon-13 into much nitrogen-14. So the ejecta from the nova is very, very rich in carbon-13. Some of this then hits the other star and pollutes it with the carbon-13, and we think that may be how this star turns into a J-type star.
So this J-type star is unlike the other carbon stars being an evolved dying star. This J-type star can just be a normal, everyday, happy star on the main sequence.
That's right.
And not an evolved one at all.
It could, but the problem is that these types of stars are very hard to spot. If you go out and you look in the sky for main sequence stars, they're very hard to see because they're so dim. I mean, if the Sun itself is not that bright. I don't know if you've seen the pictures from space probes flying off out into the edge of the solar system. Even when they look back, the Sun is not really that bright compared to the surrounding stars anymore. So it's very hard to spot them when they're little dwarf stars like the Sun. But all stars, as you know, as they get older, they get bigger and fatter, just like humans. So what happens is that they get bigger, fatter, brighter, and then you can see them. That's what we call a selection effect. So some stars you're more likely to see because they're easier to see. So we see most J stars when they're giants.
So are there any other possible explanations for J-type stars other than novae?
I'm sure there are, but I don't think anyone's thought of them yet. Other than fine-tuning models of AGB stars, these are the very evolved stars. Some of them may give J-type stars. But you have to be very careful because the spread of luminosities, we see J-type stars that are very bright, but we also see some that are not so bright. And that means that they cannot be the most evolved stars. And remember, only the most evolved stars make the carbon. So to get the carbon, you need a very, very bright star, and these are not bright. So that's a problem for the models otherwise. But I've not seen any other good model of the J-type stars yet. That's why this work is quite exciting, I think. I mean, it involves explosions, and it comes up with an idea to solve a problem that's been around for a long time. Doesn't mean to say there aren't problems with it. For example, most novae are oxygen-rich, and an oxygen-rich nova will not give us a carbon-rich star. But there are a few novae that have been observed that are carbon-rich. So it's not completely crazy. There's also another interesting statistic about these stars. A lot of them have disks around them that are oxygen-rich. How do you get an oxygen-rich disk from a carbon-rich star? I don't know. I don't think anybody knows. There are some speculations in the literature, but it's other binary-type models and stuff like that, but nothing that's really convinced anyone yet.
So by disk, you mean material surrounding the star?
Apparently so. The disk itself is quite cool. So when you look in the infrared spectrum, it's very easy to see, and you can see all sorts of details about the structure of crystals and dust in the disk. This is very, very useful to us. I'm told by the experts on disks, which I should say is not me, that the disk is almost certainly what we call a circumbinary disk, which means it surrounds the whole system. It looks just like circumbinary disks in other evolved stars that we know about. So, but we still don't know how it's made. We just know that it is there. And the central star is carbon-rich and the disk is oxygen-rich. You can see that from the silicates in these disks. So, I mean, silicates are like little particles of dusty, sandy stuff. So, I think you know more about that than me. So, save that for the next one.
Okay. So, how many J-type carbon stars are there that we know about?
Okay. In total, of course, I mean, it depends where you look. The galaxy is very difficult to say because you don't see all the stars. Many of them sit behind the galactic disk. But I can give you statistics for the Magellanic Clouds. For example, the Large Magellanic Cloud, which is a great place to look because we know the distance. So when we get luminosities, we know them pretty well. And in that, there's about 1,500, that's 1,500 carbon stars, of which about 150 are J-type. So it's quite a lot. There's a lot of stars we can look at. Of course, the problem with the Magellanic Cloud is it's still a reasonable distance away, so it's a bit harder to get detailed spectra for everything and look at every isotope in detail. Carbon-12 and carbon-13 are the easy isotopes. The other ones are even harder to see. So I think after this work, there's a lot of follow-up work we could do to look at many of these stars to look for signatures of other isotopes that are, for example, made in novae, such as lithium, and these strange nitrogen 14 and 15 isotopes. I think we could do looking at those.
And have we seen any novae in the Large Magellanic Cloud?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know. I'm not sure about that.
So the novae we've seen are in the galaxy,
of
which
right.
The majority have been oxygen-rich novae.
That's right.
And then there's some carbon-rich novae. What's the difference between the oxygen-rich novae and the carbon-rich novae? Is it the chemicals produced that we see afterwards?
That's right. So the nova expands. Now, you can take a spectrum of the nova as it expands and look at the amount of carbon and oxygen in this expanding shell of gas that becomes like a nebula around the nova. However, to my knowledge, no one has really taken detailed spectra of the star, the donor star in the nova. It may be very difficult to do because it'd be enshrouded by this expanding shell. And novae go off in these systems once every 100,000 years or so. So, unless the nova has already happened, it's very difficult to say where it will happen next. You just look at it and it looks like any normal binary star. And you can't say if it will explode next week, next month, next year. It's every 100,000 years. It's very rare. So that going back is difficult. But it may be possible. That's something I want to look into.
So we're going to have to wait 100,000 years to be able to test your hypothesis about this being a nova star.
There are other ways to test it that are easier, I think, than that. I think if we look for the telltale signs of the nova itself in the J-stars, it'll be more obvious. And then when you look at the J-stars, we need some binary statistics on them. We don't have any at the moment. We have circumstantial evidence from these disks that they're circumbinary, but it's circumstantial at the moment. So we need more direct evidence for these. But that involves a long-term monitoring program, and that's a lot of resources. So we have to persuade people that this will work.
So all these J-stars have disks?
No, only 10%. But the disk may not survive that long. So if the disk only lives for a few thousand years, you wouldn't expect to see all of them with it. I mean, 10% would be 10,000 years out of 100,000 years. So if the disk can live for 10,000 years, then that makes sense to some extent. But still, I think the disk is the hardest thing in our model to explain. It's very, very difficult.
Could it be different mechanisms that make the ones with disks and ones without disks?
That's certainly possible, yes. I mean, our model is a general model for making the J-star itself. And we decided at the beginning we would attack the other 90% before we get to this 10%, because that's they're even more mischievous. So we'll get to those, though. I think there are possibilities for making them. One possibility is that as the system, as you have many, many novae in the binary system and the J star is being polluted, what will happen is because the nova ejects material into space, the mass, the total mass that's in the binary star system will go down because it's being ejected. And as that happens, the system will get wider and wider. This is because the gravitational pull between the stars is less, so they can move further apart. And this is fine, but it means that the accretion efficiency, the amount of material that hits the companion star, will get much smaller because it's further away, which makes sense. Now, is it possible that the nova starts off being carbon-rich and eventually becomes oxygen-rich? That may happen. And if you dig down into the surface of the white dwarf, eventually it becomes oxygen-rich. It starts off carbon-rich and then becomes oxygen-rich as you dig deeper. And this is because deeper inside the star, it was hotter, so it could burn carbon-12 itself into oxygen. So remember I said carbon-12 has 12 nucleons. Oxygen-16 is 12 plus 4. That's just another helium. So it may be that the nova itself that is time-dependent. We'd never really taken that into account before. I don't think anyone's ever taken that into account. That's something to look into, and we hope to do that soon.
And is this nova a one-time-only occurrence, or can it happen multiple times in the system?
Oh, it must happen multiple times. And typical nova gives off 1/10 millionth of a solar mass of material, which is tiny. But these systems can live for the nuclear lifetime of the star, which is 10 gigayears, that's 10 billion years. So if they go off as a nova once every 100,000 years, that's a lot of novae.
Yeah, that's a lot of thermonuclear explosions
going
on.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. Exactly.
Are there any differences between the star itself, the ones that have disks and the ones that do not have disks? Like, for example, are they all heavier than average, lighter, or are they...
We don't know.
Okay.
It's very difficult to measure the mass of the star, because it's not something you can just look at a star and say the mass is one solar mass or 5 or 10. In general, you need to know if it's in a binary. And from the binary motion, so this is the stuff that Kepler did a few hundred years ago, you can tell how massive the stars are. The problem is most of these stars, or in fact, as far as I know, we don't know if any of them are binaries. No one's ever monitored them. And for those in the Magellanic Clouds, it will be difficult. And indeed, in red giants in general, it's very difficult to get binary statistics on them. Because to look for a binary, you look for spectral lines that move. But they naturally move in these stars, because these stars have big convection zones on the surface. Things are mixing around. It's very difficult to get an exact measurement of that. So these things are very difficult to do. But they can be done. It's just no one's really looked at the J-stars. I think one other reason nobody's looked at the J-stars in great detail in this sort of way is because there was no model to test. And as long as there's no theoretical model, people say, well, we know nothing, and that's it. So, and, you know, maybe they're not so useful for cosmology. So, but actually, I say that, but they are relevant, because the systems that make novae, the more we can understand about those, the more we understand about accretion onto white dwarfs. And it's accretion onto a white dwarf, albeit at a slightly higher rate than in a nova, but very, very similar binary system. These systems make type 1a supernovae. And type 1a supernovae are critical for calculating how fast the universe is expanding. So all astrophysics is related, and I think the work that we're doing on this has implications for that field as well.
Thank you very much, Rob, for telling us the mystery one piece at a time, giving us all the clues and a model about the J-type stars and a possible explanation for why they're there. Thank you again for being on the Jodcast.
Anytime.